is Kevin Schellenbach with Architecture Talk, podcasting analysis and criticism of the built environment. This is episode number 13. Today, I'd like to tell you two stories. Now, these two stories aren't particularly new, not particularly revolutionary, but they're true, and they deal with how we exist within the world, how the larger construction of our built environment affects how we live. In the first story, we start on a porch. Not a particularly remarkable porch, I suppose, but the fact that it's elevated from the street gives it a certain amount of separation. It delineates it clearly as private space. Porches are really interesting that way, and the problem with the porch, of course, is it does pose accessibility options. But, you know, a few short steps, and we're on the sidewalk. Now, the first thing that happens when you reach the sidewalk is you have a choice. You have the ability to turn north or south. In this particular neighborhood, on this particular street, I know that there's significantly different events that will happen depending on which way I choose to go. Today, I'm going to walk north. I'm heading towards public transportation, and it's the most direct route. After going just a few more steps, I generally will walk past someone. It's a fairly busy street, and it's not uncommon to have a chance meeting with someone as I'm walking along. This particular segment of the street contains a mix of single-family houses, standing on their own pieces of land, and a few condominiums, two-flat, three-flat type situations, in a moderate density. At the end of the block, I reach probably the least urban condition on this particular story. When I reach the corner, I realize that there is a large flaw in the sort of fabric of the neighborhood, and that is that there is a four-lane road that cuts across the path that I'm walking. Of course, this does also present the option for another choice. I can turn this time east or west. And I know that depending on which way I go, again, there's a lot of different things that I might encounter. If I go west, I know that there's a number of different shops and services. There's a pharmacy that's placed very tight on the corner that helps define the space of this intersection. Opposite of that, there's a bank, which is set a little bit more off the street. And the worst corner, the corner that sort of fails, is one with a parking lot. It's too open, it's too loose, it doesn't sort of hold the space of the street together. And that's one reason why this particular four-lane street I'm crossing has become more of a suburban-type environment. Many of the developments are isolated buildings with parking around them, and it's a matter of contention within the neighborhood. The development plan is being structured to make this a more urban street. But today, I decide that I need to continue on to public transportation, and I continue going north, and I walk along the street. Now, as I go a little bit further along, the sense of enclosure increases. I encounter first a large nursing home that's placed very close on the street. The entrance is immediately on a sidewalk, which is frankly too narrow. In order to make the street more accessible for cars, the sidewalks have been cut back. And so this sidewalk is much more narrow than it should be. There's also an elderly lady that often walks during the day up and down the street, and occasionally I'll run into her and be able to say hello. We don't know each other's name, we just know that we're individuals we each see on the street, on the sidewalk, fairly frequently. The next intersection is a little more interesting, and again, it's a set of choices. And as this neighborhood is set up as a grid, I understand that I could have a number of different ways to go where I'm, that I could go east, west, north, go around the block, and still end up at the same location, and am not fixed into only one way of getting there. This corner is more residential in character. It has the nursing home on one corner, it has a condominium on two other corners, and actually I think the third apartment building has become a condominium as well. So they're higher density type buildings that are defining the corners on this intersection. The next block is largely residential. It's mostly single-family houses and a few multi-tenant buildings. And as I go a couple of more blocks, that density begins to increase until I begin to encounter more retail-type situations. There's a restaurant, a very good restaurant, in fact. There's a few less frequently visited stores that are very specialty items, a knitting store, if that's anything that might interest you. A few travel agencies, but all of these retail locations are placed right on the street. They have immediately adjacency to the street, and the people who are working in them can look out and see the street, and the people walking by can look in and have a vague sense of what goes on in that particular retail location. there's also a church, and the church has events. Occasionally you see weddings, people getting into their limousines after the wedding, and people that go in and out of the church at different times. Often in the morning when I take this walk, I see a couple of people that become recognizable after a while going into the church. Another thing that this church does is it houses the local, a rotation of the local PADS service, which is a rotating homeless shelter where different churches and other places host homeless people for a couple of nights, and it rotates around. And you can always tell when PADS is at this particular church because there'll be sort of a little field of homeless people hovering around waiting for it to open. As I continue to walk down the street, it becomes denser and there's more people, and as there's more shops that people frequent, it begins to become more active and there's more life on the street. There's parking, there's very few parking lots off the street that allow the urban fabric to erode, and it's really just a fairly rich, visually interesting environment as well. The buildings range in age from 80 to maybe 20 years old. In fact, I don't think there's, on this particular walk, if I'd gone the other way, there'd be some newer buildings, of course. But this way, there aren't any particularly new buildings, and they all wear their age fairly well. They've gained character over time. They're often a very textural material. They're made out of brick. Often the houses are made out of wood siding, and there's a few really nice examples of Victorian architecture along this direction as well. There's another couple of restaurants that I quickly encounter. Some of them, they're always of different character, and there's the fancier restaurants for more dining at dinner. There's the lunch restaurants, the cafes, coffee house type cafes. And, you know, as you get more into the center of the town I live near, they become, it's sort of interesting, they become gentrified and yuppied, and they are the institutions that you are beginning to see, institutions, the corporations, frankly, that you're beginning to see in most of the nicer, smaller towns that sort of surround larger cities. So there's, of course, there's a Starbucks, there's the one with the caribou, and all those type coffee houses. And then they're actually well-placed. They're usually on the street. They're very active locations. And in terms of their role in defining sort of a streetscape, it really doesn't matter as long as it's a coffee shop, which defines an activity during a certain period of time for that portion of the street. At this point is where I reach a train, public transportation. There's a bridge that goes underneath it. Now, if you cross the train, you really begin to get more in the center of the historic area of the town. And that's when you have this funny condition that begins to happen. There's developers that seem to have realized that in a lot of these smaller historic villages, of course, around Chicago, we call it the more suburban type towns of villages, they have realized that they're prime shopping areas. So instead of developing your Gap in the mall, they're developing a Gap store in your historic village. They generally will come in and purchase a block or half a block, level it, and build some new pseudo-historical language of architecture in its place, which of course is devoid of all the character and interest that the previous buildings had taken on over their existence there. Now, there's a couple of things that are important in this story, and one of them is the fact that it's all done with walking, that you're experiencing the quality of the space and the hardscape and the environment very directly in a very tactile fashion through moving yourself with your feet along the path that you choose, along with the fact that there are a number of options to go from one place to another, and you're able to sort of experience these in a much more physical, tactile way than you would if you were in a car. The second story is a much different story. It happens at a different location, and it starts at the house of an acquaintance. Unfortunately, the only way to get to that person's house to start the story is through driving, and you'll soon see as we start to walk from that doorstep the conditions that make that necessary. As you step down from this house, there's a long sidewalk, and you realize the front door, the front side and face of the house is pretty much dominated by parking. The garage is the most important part of the house from a visual standpoint. As you go down to the street, it's highly unlikely that you're going to encounter anyone because the streets just aren't used in a pedestrian fashion. There is, of course, the same choice left to right, but when you look down the street, there's no difference. The path going south and north are both lined with similarly sized, similarly detailed, and similarly constructed houses that vary only in shades of taupe and occasional brick and occasional shifts in details that appear more of a marketing strategy than a chance to actually make a unique and interesting place for people to live. As you walk down the street, that condition continues. Each house is the same. There's no variance. Even though you're using your feet in this story and moving and experiencing the space, there's not a lot of significant change. As you get to the next street, which is, by the way, an extremely long way and have the opportunity to turn, you realize that even if you do turn there, the condition doesn't change, and all you're encountering are the same size, scale, and condition of the single-family houses. There is really, within a walking distance, not any services after this first choice and another choice, and there's another choice, and chances are you might loop back around to the same place like you could in any block situation. But within that neighborhood, there is no way to reach a main street other than two, often, exits. So as you walk and go a very long way before encountering any sort of shift in the scale of your environment, you finally reach an intersection. In this case, there's a stoplight there, and it's another four-lane road, which is a very non-pedestrian-friendly condition. And here you are introduced with more of a choice. You can go straight, which goes into the neighborhood, which is identical to the one we were just in across the way, or you can turn left or right, which is walking down a four-lane street. And, you know, often in these suburban conditions, there's not even a sidewalk. I've gone to many places in the far suburban Chicago where there's a bus stop with no sidewalk leading to it. So even if someone did choose to try and take the public transportation, and many are forced to, there is no way to get there on a sidewalk, and you're forced to go through mud or walk adjacent to the street on a gravel side, which is an extremely dangerous thing to do in order to get to the public transportation. This particular street is, of course, very busy, and there's really the main thing you hear is the sound of cars. And an interesting thing is a lot of zoning codes and ordinances force the streets to be developed with rows of trees on them, and this is a fairly good example of that. There's a large median, which of course is a nice green space with beautiful trees on it that you can't even hardly get to in order to enjoy. And when you look at the spatial definition of the street, both on the left and the right side, there is an 8-foot tall blank wall, which seems like an extremely inhuman way to treat a street, which is, in a good urban sense, a social condenser. It's a place where activity happens and people are able to encounter each other. But since everyone uses nothing but an automobile, which is an isolating element which prevents an individual from having any sort of contact with the people around them, no one really cares how humanistic the street is unless it's experienced at the scale of whatever the speed limit is, 35 miles an hour, which no one ever drives anyway. But the scale of the development as it happens in these locations happens at the size of a farm. The developer purchases essentially as much street as possible and then feels like they have to internalize all of their needs. And part of what goes into that is the zoning ordinances that cause development to happen and control where development of different types can happen is very isolationist in terms of program. It's not legal to build a restaurant near a residential area. Although, of course, you know, it's going to happen, but it's going to happen like the restaurant is in your backyard across a fence and there's no access for a person walking. You have to get in your car, drive around the block out to the main road and then into the restaurant, even though it's maybe 50 yards away in order to get there. And that's the condition of development in the majority of America. It's not human. It's not a scale that can be experienced by a person other than one in a car in any sort of successful fashion. As I'm walking down the street, that 8-foot wall that goes on the side of the street is built that way because the houses in the development are facing the suburban, neighborhood street, the street that all the other houses, the same street that all the other houses in development face, as opposed to facing the main street, where in an urban-type setting, the activity happens and the life of the people begins to be centralized. And part of this has a good part to do with the isolationist zoning which, you know, the zoning started to happen for a number of reasons. And one of the biggest reasons is, frankly, safety. You can't have a dangerous factory with people living too near it, especially with dangerous emissions. And so all of the reasons for that to happen originally were valid and needed to happen, and zoning is, in a large sense, a good thing. However, zoning needs to encourage the interaction of people as well, and the separating of human services from the humans and where people live is a very negative factor. It's also true that the consumerist nature of the American suburb also makes the car the most valuable element. The car is the most important thing that space is designed for, not the people. And so when you consider the model of the suburb where it's a building, object building, not a spatially experienced building, but an object building in a field of parking, that happens largely because of the necessity of the field of parking. So just to summarize this, this story is very much is similar to other rants I've done about the nature of urban versus suburban space, but what I've tried to do is give it a little bit more of a tactile quality and an experiential quality, because that's what it's about. It's about experiencing the quality of the space that you inhabit. And although, you know, the inside of your Ford or Honda or Volkswagen, whatever, might be the most tactile thing that you experience when you leave your door, I think that's kind of a sad thing. So when you think about how you want to live, and how you set up the life that you have, and how you want to exist in the spaces that you have, there are choices. It's possible for an individual to make a choice to live in a particular urban situation in such a way that you're not isolating yourself. You're not forcing yourself to experience the world only through your windshield. And I think that choice is something valuable and something good to think about. In terms of the architecture talk future and where we're going with the show, I hope you all noticed that I have upgraded the audio quality, and I hope it sounds good. I'd like to encourage everybody to go and visit our website too, which is www.schellarch.com/archtalk, and please let me know what you think at archtalk@gmail.com, that's archtalk@gmail.com. And also, there's a couple of other things of interest going on at the website. Of course, because podcasts are tied in with blogs, there's always the opportunity to go and leave a comment on the blog and let me know what you think that way, and let all the listeners who frequent the website see as well. And I've also started a Flickr web stream, a photo stream. Anybody that's familiar with Flickr, you know that it's a place where you can upload photographs. And what I thought I would do is allow a place for listeners to send in photographs, and I would post some of my own photographs there so that we can get our own sort of personal look at some of the buildings and spaces that we've been able to experience, and share that on the web, because that's what the web is all about. Thank you for listening. I know there's a few other architecture podcasts out there, and maybe we'll have a show soon and talk about some of those. It's really great to hear everybody communicating in this way, and I hope everybody continues to listen. Thank you, and thank you for listening to Architecture Talk.